sambalu evana nakukango kandai sekwinuka asai malikilwa nukyama kukango kawaiyo sogiyo wasai mamukulia eluke kukango kawaiyo sogiyo wasai mamukulia eluke. Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate, and that was David Zomo with Kuka Kuka. Coming Home, I think, is the name of that. And I picked that song for a very particular reason. We're talking today, we're going to spend the hour today with Gugi Wathiongo, talking about his memoir, the first volume of his memoir, Dreams in a Time of War. Really fascinating, very powerful book, telling a story of a whole place and time and the shifting of times and the shifting of conditions and talking about the dreams that drive things forward. For people who don't know, Gugi is a distinguished professor of English and comparative literature at the University of California, Irvine. He was also for a while, he was the initial director of the International Center for Writing and Translation at UC Irvine. But he's also a writer who is world renowned. I mean, his body of work is gigantic. Everything, novels, plays, poetry, critical and literary theory. It's just remarkable. And each book that I read, I've followed his work for quite some time now. Each book that I've read has taken me deeper and deeper into a place that I really loved being, both instigating a lot of thought, a lot of critical thinking, and taking me on trips and putting dreams in my head that I really found to be a valuable part of my life and of my learning about the world, both as it is and as it could be and as it should be. Very, very interesting body of work. Gugi was also put in jail by the Kenyan dictator Moi, Daniel Arap Moi, and he was put in there for a play that he did. It was called I Will Marry When I Want, and he became a Amnesty International prisoner of conscience, and after a year in jail, he did two things. One, there was a campaign to get him out of jail by Amnesty International. After a year, he was released, but during that year, he also wrote another novel, The Devil on the Cross, and he wrote that one on toilet paper, the only material he had available to him while he was in jail. He has been in exile since the early 80s, and he was first in London, in England, and then he was here in the States. And he's continued to write and to really dig into things and to generally produce a body of work that was very anti-colonial, anti-neocolonial, that dealt with the idea of what do people need to actually get free. So join me in welcoming my favorite writer in the world, Gugi Wathiongo. Gugi, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you.
Tell us a little bit about, you have a new memoir out. It's called Dreams in a Time of War. What drove you to make a memoir after all these years of writing and you've huge body of work, like I said, what drove you to actually turn to a memoir?
Yeah, actually, I give credit to my wife, Jerry. And I'll tell you a little story. Our two youngest kids, who are now no longer young, I mean, they're still young, but they're now 15, 16. But when they are young, they were born in New Jersey. And in the early days, I would try to motivate them by telling them about the kind of education, how hard it was for us in Kenya during the colonial days to get education. Because I wanted to motivate them to be able to seize whatever opportunities there were here in America, in terms of education. But my son turned around when I told him, look, Sonny, we walked on foot for 6 miles every day for many years. No shoes, 6 miles. Instead of my son being amazed, as I had hoped, he turns around and says, Daddy, your parents, you know, how cruel they were. Why would they not drive you to school or even buy you a pair of shoes? Now, so my point, in a sense, was lost. And then later we sent them to Kenya for a year, when they went to a village school where they saw children going without shoes, and they were part of that for a year. So when they came back, they did not ask any more questions about my grandparents not being able to buy me shoes. Now, my wife was telling me, look, there are many more children like those. I think people need to hear your story. Your grandchildren need to hear your story. People who are struggling for school, for education, whatever, they need to hear your story of survival, of struggle for school, for education, and so on. It's a memory you must leave to them. So, at long last, I did sit down and write a memoir, Dreams in a Time of War.
Now, this is the first volume of your memoirs, right?
It's going to be the first volume. I want to tell the story of how it felt like to grow up in a colonial situation. You know, first of all, let me just tell you, I was born in 1938, on the eve of the Second World War. Some of my brothers were caught up in that war. But soon after the Second World War, in 1952, Mau Mau War of Liberation started in Kenya. So I grew up in that period of the Second World War and also of anti-colonial resistance, you know, anti-colonial resistance in Kenya. This is a story I won't tell, but I won't tell the story of how I grew in that particular village to how, if you like, I ended up in as a distinguished professor of English and comparative literature at the University of California, Irvine.
Not to mention a guy who came from this little tiny village in Kenya and whose books now are translated into more than 30 languages.
Yeah. How I became a writer. I want to tell the story of how I became a writer and that whole process of writing, the process of imagination. And so, in other words, the various, for instance, in Dreams in a Time of War, I have to tell the story of how even a person who lives in whatever corner of the world will be affected by whatever happens in any other part of the world. When people talk about the Second World War, mostly African people are left out in terms of participation in that war. And although they were not always willing participants, they were fighting on the side of some of the colonial powers. But nevertheless, African people fought in the Middle East. They fought in the East Africa campaign. They fought in Burma. They were part of the North Africa campaign. They participated in all those battles. Yet when the story of the Second World War and even the First World War is told, Africa tends to be left out. Yeah. So I want to show in the memoir how, not in an abstract way, but how we ourselves, in our tiny little village, far away from the capital city of Nairobi, how we also got sucked in to the Second World War. Meaning, for instance, one of my half-brothers was in the Second World War. One of my cousins, in fact, died in that war, and so on. So I want to tell the impact of that, not by preaching about it, but I want to show the impact, or I have to show that although we lived in this particular village, we were part of what was happening in the rest of the world.
We're talking today with world-renowned Kenyan author Ngugi wa Thiong'o about his new memoir, Dreams in a Time of War. Let's pursue this a little bit, because it's true, reading your memoir, and I've read it twice, and I look at it and I think it's a deeply personal story of a young Kenyan guy, born, raised in a fairly small village, as you're talking about, remote place in colonial Kenya. Yet it's a story that's told within the unfolding of these huge events in the world. There's the development of colonialism that actually, frankly, even in the span of time, wasn't that long before you were born. Then at the same time, you're in a period where the world then erupts into war. There's terrible things going on all over the world. And you're also moving into neocolonialism, and there's the anti-colonial struggle, and then there's the neocolonialism that spans. Mm-hmm. You can begin to see how the world is shifting in great ways. And you and I have talked about this before. It really, what you bring out in the book is the idea and the connections between things, the idea that you could be sitting in a small village and actually those things impact you. They impact you and they come into your life in ways that one might never expect.
Right, absolutely. Because one of my running themes, even in my novels. It's just the idea of how connected people are, meaning that the struggles for anywhere in the world are really part of any other person in any other part of the world, you know, because those events somehow or other can and often do impact us, as you say, in ways that we never know. Let me tell you a little story. You know, I'm a storyteller, so you know. actually, it's in the book. Actually, it's not a story because it's actually, or rather, it's a story which is narrated in Dreams in a Time of War. In my village, or rather, my father had four wives, so we had a little compound. And our household, or rather our compound, had never been visited by, nor car, nor vehicle, motor vehicle, had ever come to that particular compound. And then one night, around 1944-43, there's this military lorry that drove into a compound. It got stuck in the mud. It was actually our half-brother coming to visit us with on the way to Madagascar or some other, you know, location from yet another campaign. So he was stealing that moment with his friends to come and see us because some of us had never seen him in the first instance. But their lorry got stuck in the mud. So instead of, oh, we have, you know, so this sort of great moment of temporary reunion, they spent almost half the night trying to dig out the truck. But not before the truck had struck my mother's heart. And so whenever I think of the Second World, when I've narrated this I think actually of my mother's heart, you know, and this visit by night by this military vehicle with a military man wearing camouflages and so on. So, Second World War, my mother's heart leaning on one side. That's actually how I think of the Second World War, in a very personal way.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. And we're talking today with Gugi Wathiyongo, just an amazing writer and a world-renowned writer. And we're talking about his new memoir, Dreams in a Time of War. Now, Gugi, as you're talking about this, you know, it's interesting because I kept thinking in all the ways that you brought out how the world impinged on your life in a certain sense, that actually it really does drive home a point that so much of what happens to us, even though we may be in a remote village, unconnected with much of the rest of the world, especially at that time in history, that was if you're in a remote village in Kenya, you're in a remote village, you know.
Right.
And I know even today there were places when I was in Africa, there were places where people really had no conception of what it meant to be over the sea,
right,
very rural
right.
areas, and they had long pipes that they would describe as across the sea pipes.
Right, know? Right.
But they had no idea what did it mean that the U.S. was over there. They had heard generally. But there's a way that imperialism, the way that this world, this global system, in some ways determines or has more of an impact on us than we ever realize, even when we're in these places that would be so seemingly unconnected. Like, I can't help but remember the things that you talked about in your memoir about the ways that this happened, including whether it was Hitler or the bombing of the dropping of the nuclear bombs.
Yeah, exactly. For instance, I mean, I have described this in my memoirs, but when I was growing up, there are all these young people who are much older than I was, you know, who had these sort of youth dances. And one of the refrains in one of those dances is of the soloist always saying that I did these heroic things and this, you know. And then the refrain was, as I went to drop a bomb in Japan. Now, I didn't know that they were talking about this momentous event. I'm not even sure whether they themselves were consciously aware of the enormity of what they were talking about, okay? But obviously, this is how the news or the event of the bombing of Hiroshima translated in popular music and dance among the youth. In other words, in the dances and the stories of the time, no matter how strange those stories may have seemed to be, there was always a bit of mention of some names, you know. It could be Hitler, it could be Churchill, it could be Roosevelt. You know, countries would also be mentioned, particularly, you know, not only in songs, but sometimes in stories in the evening. You could talk about such names, you know, Germany or America, Joe Louis. So those become almost like images in a child's mind, but obviously is a mirror into the world. Although to us, when we were growing up, these events were coming across as just part of stories of events, you know. And sometimes for us children, we thought that these figures were fictional, you know, like since we had also stories which were fictional, some of these characters sounded like they were these huge sort of, you know, monsters in a mythical kind of landscape.
And meanwhile, what was going on with all these, you know, these characters and what they were doing in the world actually was really very, very fundamentally and decisively shifting the ground, the political and the human ground, in even in Kenya.
Oh, yes. Our lives were being changed, you know, right there. In fact, an interesting thing, actually, in terms of this connection, okay, take, for instance, my half-brother fighting in the Second World War. When they come back from that war, no jobs for them. Yet their British white counterparts had jobs and land and everything else, you know. So among the generation of my half-brother who had been to the Second World War was a generation that was also the backbone of the military wing of the Mau Mau resistance against the colonial state. In other words, the very fact that they had been part of this fighting machine also gave them the idea that they could fight against that machine also, okay? So, and then the Mau Mau resistance and all the deaths and everything else that were part of that resistance, again, was affecting our lives directly. Okay? One of my brothers was part of the Mau Mau guerrilla army. So you can see how the Second World War, Mau Mau, my brothers, you know, were all caught up in this, you know. So they are connected, you know. Events happening in Europe were also affecting us in Kenya. They were affecting my education in Kenya, my struggle for school. It was part of that. So, you know, it's true that momentous things, we are part of those momentous events happening in the world, whether we are consciously aware of it or not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And actually, in a lot of ways, what we do, we can act upon those events, too, once we actually understand, which a lot of your book actually we'll get into a little bit later, but it digs into your struggle to actually understand the world. And maybe we'll get into this a little bit now. You've mentioned education quite often in this interview and in your book. It's a theme that runs through the entire book, is the struggle for education, for you to get an education. And as I was reading it, I kept thinking there was a couple times where you also mentioned that in some ways you were confronted with the fact that you really wanted to get educated, but you were confronted with the fact as you got older, or maybe even in looking back and writing the memoir, you're confronted with the fact that for a large part, the educational system in Kenya actually existed either to produce African laborers or to produce functionaries to make the machinery of neocolonialism or colonialism run smoothly. Right. And you've spent your life also wrestling with the idea of decolonizing the mind.
You know? Yeah, it is, because nothing is really, everything has two sides. It's true, actually. First of all, what is very, very interesting is this. The connection, again, let me just deal with the idea of connection for reasons. Mm-hmm. Take for instance, when I went to school in Kenya, I first went to a missionary type school. Then I went to an African school that was run by Independent Schools Association in Kenya. You know, the African Independent Schools Movement ran very many schools. How did it come about? The idea of self-reliance. Then I'm able to go back and see that there's a connection between the Independent Schools Movement in Kenya and Marcus Garvey, America, and Booker T. Washington and Alabama. How did that come about? Because Marcus Garvey, remember, first came to America because he had heard about Booker T. Washington. And the element that really excited his imagination was just the element that we can do things ourselves, the idea of self-reliance. But He came to America in 1914 or 15. By that time, he reached New York, Booker T had died. They could never meet. Okay? But also you remember that Marcus Garvey then became the center of this, the biggest mass movement of black peoples in history. His movement produced a journal, a magazine, that actually was read in many parts of Africa, read by the educated people who then translate some of those ideas to others. Okay, the idea that I think excited people's imagination was again the idea of self-reliance. So when they found schools in Kenya, which were not government-run and were not missionary-run, they called them independent schools. But the word independence in a colonial state meant something else. Okay, in fact, they struggled even to get the name independent schools inserted as part of their name. So here I am going to in a school which is connected with all these other events in history in ways that I did not, quite know. Yeah.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. And I'm talking today with Gugi Wathiongo, a world-renowned writer, and we're talking about his memoir, first the volume of, and I'm hanging on the edge of a cliff here waiting for these other volumes, Gugi, so you got to get your work done here.
But
the first volume of his memoir, which is Dreams in a Time of War. Now, Gugi, I wanted to, it's funny because as we talk, I keep thinking, an hour is passing so quickly. No, don't get up and leave. We got a little bit more to go here. Well, actually, you know what? Maybe what we should do is we should take a quick break, and we'll be right back to continue our discussion with Gugi Wathiongo about his memoir, Dreams in a Time of War. Welcome back. You're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. And that was more from the album African Politics by David Zomo. In fact, that piece was called African Politics. And joining us in conversation today is Gugi Wathiongo, a world-renowned writer, playwright, author, novelist, poet, critical theorist, literary theorist, and generally all-around guy who lives for constructing and helping people to build a whole different future free of oppression and the rest of this, all this insanity that we live in today in the world that actually shapes us, but also that we have a responsibility, I think, to stand up and take on. Now, Gugi, as we're going along here, you mentioned that earlier about being a storyteller, and you are one of the greatest storytellers I've come across. And there's a whole scene I'd like you to read from your memoir. There's a whole scene in your book that paints a scene of storytelling and how much a role that played in your life. And I think from the very beginning, from the opening chapter all the way through the book, the idea of storytelling is a theme that is like a giant river running through your life. Can you read that section?
Yeah. First of all, to get the setting, I mentioned that my father had four wives. My mother was the third of the wives. So we are quite a number of siblings, And in the evening, we'd always meet at the elder, we called all the four wives, we called them our mothers, elder mother, second mother, or whatever. So we'd all crowd in the elder mother's house, the oldest. Her name was Wangari, and she was really a very good storyteller. Anyway, Wangari, the eldest, was always calm, as if she had seen everything in life. Her power over my father was through a look or a gesture of disapproval, as if reminding him that it was she was the one who had chosen him over his brother. She was a kind of minister of culture, a philosopher who drew from experience and cited proverbs to make a point. She was a great storyteller. Every evening, we children gathered around the fireside in her hut, and the performance would begin. Sometimes, particularly on weekends, the older siblings would bring their friends, and it would then become a story session for all. One told a story. After it ended, another person from the audience would say something like, "Oh, that reminds me of," or such other words, a signal that he or she was going to tell a story, even if, as it turned out, in most cases, the new story had nothing to do with the one that apparently provoked it. But the comment did not always mean another story. It could also bring a narration of an episode illustrating the truth of an aspect of the story. Sometimes such opinions and illustrations generated heated debates that had no clear winner, and they often flowed into yet other stories. Or sometimes they led to stories about events in the land and the world, like when they talked about the age groups and how times change, citing the case of Harithuku, whose political fire of the 1920s had become old ash following his release in 1929 after 7 years of exile. They would also talk about other societies like the Kikuyu Central Association, the successor to Harithuku's East African Association, and so on. They would talk about how people were angry with the new Thuku because he was seen as cooperating with the colonial demands. The arguments about the merits and demerits of two approaches were above my head and quite boring, but the historical anecdotes were all right because, for me, they were still part of the oral universe of storytelling. Some of them sounded stranger than fiction, like the case of a white man called Hitler refusing to shake the hand of the fastest runner in the world in 1936 because the man, Jesse Owens, was black.
Amazing. From Dreams in a Time of War. And, you know, that scene, it goes on. And as I said, there's this idea of storytelling just flows through so much of what you've, of book and of your life. And it was actually a struggle. I mean, this, in some ways, the idea of getting an education actually had a lot to do with even finding words. You know, I think in terms of what I could see from what you did, you know, you were always looking for, and you were always attracted to the storytelling and wanting to tell stories. It was such a big part of your cultural life in the broadest sense. But the idea of having the words to actually be able to do that, that was part of education. But you also ran up against something, because in a lot of ways, your language, when you went to get educated, your language sometimes would be taken away from you.
Yeah, I talked about it. Again, I talk about it. I talk about this in the memoirs, because what happened was this. When the schools were run by the Independent Schools, African Independent Schools Association, we learned the Kikuyu language, my language, alongside English and other subjects. Okay, there was no conflict between learning my language, knowing my language, and understanding and knowing English language. In fact, we were encouraged to know as much of English as we could to add to what we already had and were having in our own languages. And that was fine to me, okay? In history, again, in these schools, they were able to tell us about, you know, resistance in South Africa. We learn about, you know, Shaka, the great kings, you know, in South Africa, like Shaka, Setswayo, and others. It was very, very exciting. And then in 1952, as part of the colonial reaction to Mau Mau resistance, they banned Mau Mau, but they also banned all schools associated with the notion of independence. So all the schools run by the Independent Schools Association were closed, including my own school in 1952, okay, for a time. But later it reopened, but now under government control. the change was really dramatic. Because where before we talked about Shaka and other African sort of stories and so on, here the emphasis on it became more of explorers, you know, the discovery of Africa, the of Mount Kenya, of the rivers, you know, of Africa. We talked about David Livingstone, you know, Henry Morton Stanley, Speke, and others, okay? That's what the emphasis. Not only that, our own language, Gikuyu language, for instance, in my case, because there are many other African languages in Kenya. But now it became a problem where my language was a pleasure. Now it was an occasion for my being beaten if I was caught speaking Kikuyu in a school compound. So our own languages were now being associated with punishment, with humiliation. On the other hand, English language, when you did very well, meant reward, praise, you know, intelligence, and so on. So in that sense, our own language was being used against us, directly and indirectly. And English language was being encouraged as the language of modernity, of advancement, of intelligence, and so on. Now, note the difference. Before, we were also learning English language, but now there was a conflict between English and African languages, with English being now the dominant language associated with everything that was positive, and African languages associated with everything that was negative. So this, I've always struggled with this aspect, because when I first went to school, and I mentioned this in my Dreams and Time of War, I was actually praised for doing very well in an essay in Kikuyu language. But later, that which had been the basis of praise had become now the basis of humiliation and negativity.
A quick reminder, you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. And we're talking today with world-renowned author Ngugi wa Thiong'o about his new memoir, Dreams in a Time of War. And actually, one of the things I know, I was going through an interview that I found. I've had this book of interviews with you for quite some time, and I was just going through it last night, just sitting around reading and preparing for our discussion today. And it reminded me of something. You really fought to eventually, you know, you had written in English your novels and some of your plays, and then you fought to actually write in Kikuyu. But what I was going to say is that there was something that you mentioned in one of these interviews, which I really connected up with what you're saying about what happened in school. You had this love of words. You had the love of the music of words. And I don't know whether that was both in English or and Kikuyu or just the love of words. One thing real quick. Mm. You also had a thing where you talked about that English, in a way, kind of constricted your ability to express yourself and your imagination to a certain extent, be able to express your imagination, that you could have much more innovative writing and storytelling in your own language.
Yeah, all languages have different possibilities. There's no language which really, in my view, which is necessarily better than another language. All languages have their tremendous possibilities, you know, and limitations as well. So English is a tremendous, you know, language. There's no doubt about it. But it's no more tremendous than, say, Kikuyu or Kiswahili or Russian or Chinese or Yoruba or Igbo. In other words, all languages have their unique kind of music and so on. And I want to just a little bit share with you, I think because you mentioned the question, how I discovered music in words. And this music was not necessarily in English. Okay. Now, just to put it in a context, my mother, who was the third wife of my father, and who would not know how to read or write, is the one who actually sent me to school. And for many years, she supervised my homework. And for a long time, I did not know actually whether she could read or write, because she would always, you know, ask me such probing questions and so on. And, you know, and initially when I go to school, because I did not know much about schooling, the etiquette and so on, you know, and I wrote on a slate with chalk and slate, which could, whenever the teacher marked, gave me a mark, I would rub it off afterwards, you know, to clean my slate.
Erase the slate.
Yeah, erase, you know, so because my slate would be clean and all that, you know. So I would go home and my mother would ask me, what I had done. Of course, I say I cleaned my slate, you know, which means I cleaned whatever marks had been put there, you know. And so
you collected up a lot of zeros.
And
huh?
So, yeah. So she told me to next time to wait until the teacher had looked at it and so on before I rub off everything. So let me just read this. The teacher also corrects me. Otherwise, I would continue getting zeros. And a while later, she starts writing on my slate, 10 out of 10. And my mother asks me what I had done. And I say, 10 out of 10. She would ask probing questions, ending with, "Is that the best you could have done?" This is a question she will keep on asking in response to my schoolwork, class exercises, and tests. "Is that the best you could have done?" Even when I tell her proudly that I scored 10 out of 10, she asks the same question in different ways until I say yes, I'd tried my best. Strange, she seems more interested in the process of getting there than the actual result. So initially I drift through the initial classes, not quite understanding why I have been moved from sub A to grade 1, all within the same quarter. A skipping of classes that continues from term to term, so that within a year, I'm in a grade 2. And still my mother continues to ask, "Is that the best you could have done?" Now, I don't know about the best that I could have done. All I know is that one day, I'm able to read on my own the Gikuyu primer we used in class. Some sentences are simple, like the one captioning a drawing of a man, an axe on the ground, his face grimacing with pain as he holds his feet, left knee in both hands, drops of blood trickling down. The picture is more interesting than the words. Kamawe etemete, etemete kuguru, etemete neidano. Kamau has cut himself. He's cut his leg. He's cut himself with an axe. I tackle long passages that do not have illustrations. There's a passage that I read over and over again, and suddenly one day I start hearing music in the words. God has given the Gikuyu a beautiful land, abundant water, food, and a luscious bush. The Gikuyu should praise the Lord all the time, for he's ever been generous to them. Even when not reading it, I can hear the music. The choice and arrangements of the words, the cadence, I can't pick any one thing that makes so beautiful and long-lived in my memory. I realize that even written words can carry the music I loved in stories, particularly the choric melody. And yet, this is not a story. It is a descriptive statement. It does not carry an illustration. It is a picture in itself. And yet, more than a picture and a description, it is music. Written words can also sing.
Written words can indeed sing.
Yeah. And what I try to do then, you know, so either in Gikuyu language or in English, I try to find that music in the words. And my resentment has been that this elevation of English into a dominant place out of proportion or in relation to the suppression of African language, that's what's wrong. Because English language has music, so also has Gikuyu language. And the two are not conflictual. They are made to be conflictual. But language in themselves do not fight against other languages.
But
they are turned into relations of power, mm-hmm. You know, of the dominant and the dominated.
Which is what has been wrong.
Which has
a lot to do with what we started out talking about these bigger forces in the world actually shaping literally every aspect of people's lives.
Absolutely, yeah.
Now, in the time we have remaining, there's something I want. Well, first, let me remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and I'm talking today with Gugi Watthiongo. And actually, just something I forgot to say in the beginning. Gugi, you have the distinction of not only all the books that you've written, all the works that you've produced, and the honors that you've got, and as I said, being jailed by the dictator Moi, but you also had the distinction of writing a book named Madagari after a character. And that character was someone who went around Kenya, was exploring what was life like under the neocolonial regime and telling the truth. And at a certain point, Moi heard about it and he ordered the arrest of Madagari. And then after a while searching for Madagari in All Points Bulletin, one of his advisors came back and said, Madagari is a book by Googie.
Right, absolutely.
And your book was arrested. So congratulations on being one of the very few people in the world to have their book arrested.
Arrested and having their fictional characters, Saru the Sawidar.
Right, exactly. Well, now, in the time we have remaining, I want to play a real quick thing. And it's about dreams, because I really want to talk about dreams for a minute. So just take a listen to this, and we'll be right back.
Bring me all of your dreams, you dreamers. Bring me all of your heart melodies that I may wrap them in a blue cloud cloth away from the two rough fingers of the world. And that is what poetry may do. Wrap up your dreams, protect and preserve them, and hold them until maybe they come true. Columbus dreamed of finding a new world. He found it. Edison dreamed of light, more light, and he made light. All the progress that human beings have made on this old earth of ours grew out of dreams. That is why it is wise, I should think, to hold fast to dreams. For if dreams die, life is a broken-winged bird that cannot fly. Hold fast to dreams, for when dreams go, life is a barren field frozen with snow.
So that was Langston Hughes.
Yeah, you know, I met him once.
Yeah.
In 1962. He came to Makerere, Kampala, Uganda, at the first conference of African writers or English expression. I was then a student at Makerere, and I was beginning to write. And here was Langston Hughes, you know, Saunders Redding, who's a very important critic, you know, African American critic. So I took Langston Hughes around Kampala. So that's how I remember him, you know. But later I discovered his books, you know, and so
I was thinking of the dream,
yeah.
Right, and I was very much reminded of his piece on the dream. Mm-hmm. With the theme of the overarching theme of your book and the title of it, Dreams in a Time of War. What's the importance of dreams? Why dreams?
Dreams. Think of dreams and imagination. In a way, dreams tell us actually what imagination does. Because you see, dreams, first of all, ordinarily dreams yoke different things together. They connect things that seemingly are not connectable or in different ways. But there's another aspect of dreams, which is to do with imagination. And imagination is like dreaming, yoking together different things to show possibilities. As Langton Hughes is saying in that particular poem, think of that without imagination, there's no human society. Without imagination, there are no buildings. Because architects imagine a building, a structure in the mind before it is put down. We can have, even when we think of a journey, we have to picture it in our minds, and then that picture becomes a guide and so on. People keep on asking me, what do you think is the role of the arts in society? And for a long time, I used to wrestle with this question, trying to come up with all sorts of explanations as to why arts were important. Then one day I realized, wait a minute, just as the body needs food to eat, the soul needs, you know, rites, you know, which includes religion and other things to cater for the spirituality which is inherent in our human society and so on. So, in the same way, dreams need nourishment. In other words, dreams and imagination, out of which has come all these in the buildings, we have this. But what nourishes the imagination? It is the arts in general. I describe it, I say, look, the arts generally are the food of the imagination. And just as the body needs to be nourished with good food, equally well, the imagination also needs to be nourished with good stories, good sculpture, good music, good painting, and so on. Because by enriching the imagination, we are also empowering it to become an even more powerful means of realizing our societal's, you know, our goals, and so on. So dreams, imagination, put them together.
Well, let me ask you this, because the title of your book is actually Dreams in a Time of War. And the intensity of that title didn't hit me until actually a little while after reading the book. Because you're talking about also, and we've talked about this, you make a comment about a guy who was a storyteller. And we only have about 3 minutes, so I'll be quick on this. But you make a comment about a guy who was a storyteller you met when you were young, and he really influenced your life. And he was able to meld together the surreal and the real. And he was able to and you said that actually perhaps it's myth as much as facts that keeps dreams alive. And I was thinking about this in relation to in the most hard conditions. Kenya, at the time that you were coming up, was a horrible place to be an African person. On one hand, it was also something that, you know, really in your culture and your family ties and your what you knew, it was also something beautiful. But it was extremely oppressive. And you have some bone-chilling parts in your book about that. But you keep this thing of dreams. And you and I have talked about this, that sometimes that really if you're going to change society, if you're going to change the world, you do have to understand the world as it is and as it could be. That's what education's about. But you have to also see the world as it should be and ought to be. And that's where dreams have a lot of influence.
Dreams, imagination. Just like now that you talk of dreams in that Langston Hughes poem, I found a poem which I've always found very interesting, written by Martin Carter, you know, from Guyana. You know, I really find it very, very moving when among the long poem, but there's one verse which I've quoted in my book where he says, he's thinking of ordinary people living trenches or in ghettos or wherever, you know, or in their own homes. And he says, I have learned from books, dear friend, of men dreaming and living and hungering in a room without a light, who could not die since death was far too poor, who did not sleep to dream, but dreams to change the world. I've always found that very, very moving indeed.
And it's defined a lot of your work.
And when you come to think of it, imagine people, say, in a guerrilla camp or in a war situation, ordinary war, but they always have time to tell stories. Why? Because stories are so crucial. It's such an important part of what constitutes the human, and to do with also with imagination, expanding the possibilities, seeing what's possible, imagining, after all, even going to the moon and other places was first imagined in stories, in the Indian myths, Mahabharata and so on, in books, you know, Jules Verne and others. They are the one who imagine going to Mars and other places, and that now has become more as, you know, a reality. So imagination opens possibilities, dreams and on open that possibility.
And on that, we're going to have to wrap this up. And I'll close with this. You know, I agree. And I think actually the point of if you're talking about getting out of a world, a horrific world for the vast majority of people in the world. And actually, if you're talking about changing that, you have to, one, deeply understand that the world doesn't have to be the way it is today. And you have to understand that based on science and analysis and materialism and all that other stuff. But you also have to be able to envision a different world that would be based on the same thing, on materialism, but also being able to soar somewhat. And to me, dreams do that. And frankly, I think the large body of your work actually has made a very, very important contribution to people being able to envision another way of life. So I wanted to thank you very much for that.
Well, thank you very much. Yeah.
And you've been listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. And we've been talking today with Gugi Watthiongo, a renowned world-renowned writer and the author of a new memoir, Dreams in a Time of War, and about a gazillion other books. And if you really want to have a trip, go out, check out the books. Well worth your while. You'll never forget them. I want to do something a little special in the minutes we have remaining in the show today. On Saturday, August 14th, a great jazz vocalist, Abby Lincoln, died. Abby was a singer who refused to follow the rules. Her work stood up against the oppression of black people and others. She sang about freedom. She sang about freedom from oppression. She sang about the struggle against it. And she sang about the lives of humans, the passions, the sufferings, the dreams, the hopes, the travails, the fight we all go through to stand up against all the insanity we face each and every day, no matter where we are in the world. Abby sang the songs of freedom and inspired all who heard her with a voice that brought added truth and power to those songs. The world got a little sadder when Abby died, but she leaves behind an unparalleled musical legacy. So we're going to take a listen to Freedom Day, from the incredible album We Insist, Freedom Now Suite, that Abby did with Max Roach, Olatunji, and Oscar Brown Jr. back in 1960. This album caused quite a stir when it was released, including being banned in South Africa on the day it was released. So without any further ado, here's Abby Lincoln with Freedom Day.
Thank you. must be lying. Can it really be? Can't conceive it, don't believe it, but that's what they say. Slave no longer, slave no longer, this is Freedom Day. Freedom Day, it's Freedom Day. Throw those shackling chains away. Everybody that I see says it's really true. We're free. Freedom Day, it's Freedom Day. Free to vote and earn my pay. Dim my path and hide away. But we've made it Freedom Day.
On Saturday, August 14th, a great jazz vocalist, Abby Lincoln, died. I want to thank my guest, Googie Watthiongo, my engineer, Melissa Figueroa, my production assistants, Mari Matsuoka and Nicole Lee, and all of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. And remember, the world cries out for revolutionary change. We don't have to live like this, and we shouldn't accept it. We didn't always live like this, and there's no reason to keep on doing it now. So let's take the chains off our heads and get down to business. I'll be back to talk with you again next week. Let's go out now with a little bit of Let My People Go from Durando.
Let my people go. Said you better let my people go.